Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are getting extremely granular, and I mean that quite literally. We're talking about the building blocks of our modern world. Steel. But not the steel you think you know.
Not at all. I mean, it's the material that, you know, holds up our skylines, keeps our cars moving. It's the infrastructure of modern life.
Exactly. And if you ask most people, even engineers, what steel is, they'll give you the standard recipe, right? Iron plus carbon. Yeah. And if they're really paying attention in material science class, they'll talk about cementite. That's the hard stuff, the reinforcement in the concrete of the atomic world.
That is the classic view, yes. Cementite, or E3C, is the rock star of iron carbides. It's stable, it's common, it gets all the credit.
It's the reliable backbone.
It is.
But, and here is where it gets really interesting, it turns out cementite is, well, it's not the whole story, it's just the ending. There's this whole secret menu of other carbides, exotic, unstable, high carbon structures that form and dissolve way before cementite ever takes the stage.
That's right. So we're looking at a specialized text, Other FEC Carbides, specifically Chapter 9. And our mission today is to explore these hidden characters. They have names like Epsilon, Eta, and Xi. They are the metastable ghosts of the steel world.
I love that phrase, metastable ghosts. Okay, so before we meet the cast, let's unpack that word. Metastable. It sounds precarious.
It does. It's less about exploding, though, and more about sitting in an uncomfortable chair. Think of it like this. Imagine a ball rolling down a hill, the very bottom of the valley, where the ball finally stops and never moves again. That's the stable state. That is cementite.
Okay, that makes sense. Gravity wins.
But the hill isn't a smooth slope, right? It has little dips and plateaus on the way down. If the ball gets stuck in one of those little dips, it stops. It looks stable. It acts stable. But if you give it a little nudge, like adding some heat, it'll roll out of that dip and keep going down to the real bottom.
So these other carbides, Epsilon, Eta, Chi, the ball getting stuck halfway down the hill.
Exactly. They're temporary resting spots. And in the life of a piece of steel, especially when you're tempering martensite or bainite, there's a very specific sequence to this. It's like a line of succession.
Walk us through that. What's the timeline?
Okay, so you start with martensite. It's just chock full of carbon, very stressed out. Then as you heat it, you get epsilon carbide, then Qi carbide, then Eta carbide, and finally the ultimate winner, cementite.
And the source says at each step, the amount of dissolved carbon drops.
Right. It's a shedding process. The iron lattice is just trying to reject all this excess carbon because it's so overcrowded. It creates these increasingly stable structures to lock the carbon away until it finally settles on the most stable ratio for cementite.
So it's the iron trying to spit out the carbon in manageable chunks. Now, usually we talk about changing steel by tossing it in a furnace, heat treatment, but the text mentions some really extreme ways these things can form that have nothing to do with a furnace.
Oh, this is where the science gets wild. We usually think you need heat to get atoms to move around. But you can also form these carbides through ion implantation.
Which sounds like something from a sci-fi movie.
It basically is. You're blasting the surface of the iron with carbon ions at incredible speeds. The amazing thing is, in these experiments, they saw epsilon, Qi, and Eta carbides forming at temperatures as low as 70 degrees Celsius.
70 degrees! That's barely a warm cup of coffee.
To get atoms to move around and form new structures in steel, don't you usually need hundreds of degrees?
Precisely. Usually you need the iron atoms to diffuse, to physically move out of the way to make room. But at 70 degrees, the iron atoms are basically frozen. They can't do any long-range diffusion.
So how does the carbide form if the iron can't move?
It's violence, essentially. The carbon ions hit with so much energy that they just force the local neighborhood of atoms to rearrange. It's not a reaction driven by heat. It's a structural rearrangement driven by pure impact and stress. It proves these phases aren't just about temperature. That is just wild. You're forcing the structure into existence. And there was another method, right? Taking plain old cementite and hitting it with a mix of hydrogen and carbon monoxide.
Yes, you can actually convert the quote-unquote stable cementite back into the metastable Eta carbide using that gas mixture. It just goes to show that stability is relative to the environment. You change the chemical atmosphere and suddenly the ghost becomes the reality.
Speaking of stability, there's this bit of drama in the text, the thermodynamic puzzle. Mm-hmm. I read this and it felt like the scientists were just arguing with reality.
It is a classic case of theory versus observation. There's a modified phase diagram that suggests if you cool a mixture down and hold it at 400 degrees Celsius, the cementite should transform into Eta carbide. Theoretically, Eta should be the stable one at that temperature.
So the math says Eta wins.
The math says Eta wins, but it is never, ever been observed in practice. You can hold steel at 400 degrees for a very long time, and the cementite just sits there, doesn't budge.
And this is where you brought in the heavy hitters to prove the point. The meteorites.
The cosmic evidence. If you want to know what the ultimate stable state of iron and carbon is, you can't just rely on a lab experiment to last a week. You need deep time. So you look at a meteorite. These things cool down in space at a rate of maybe 10 Kelvin per million years.
That's a slow cooker recipe I do not have the patience for.
It is the ultimate slow cool. And what do we find in them? Ferrite and cementite. No ita, no chi. Just cementite.
And the same with ancient steel, right?
Exactly. Perlite steel that's been aging for 2,000 years. Still ferrite and cementite. So despite what the calculations might say about driving forces at 400 degrees, nature has already voted. Cementite is the winner of the long game.
Okay, so cementite wins the war. But these other carbides have some really unique personalities. Let's dive into part two. ITA carbide, or as the text calls it, the Hegg carbide.
Named after the researcher Gunnar Hegg. Its formula is roughly F2.2C, often written as Fe5C2.
And it has a stealth mode, right? It likes to hide.
It does. This was a fantastic discovery using high-resolution electron microscopy. For a long time, metallurgists would look at cementite and see these faults or defects in the layers. It just looked like broken cementite.
But it wasn't broken.
No, it was a sandwich. What they were actually seeing was something called microsyntactic intergrowth.
That is a mouthful. Unpack that for me.
Imagine a stack of playing cards. That's your cementite crystal. Now imagine you just slip a few cards from a completely different deck right into the middle of the stack. You have layers of ITA carbide growing seamlessly inside the layers of cementite.
So you have a single crystal that's chemically part cementite, part ITA, all mixed together.
Exactly. It creates a non-stoichiometric mixture. It just blurs the line between the two phases, suggesting they're very similar structurally. Cousins, basically.
Okay, so why should we care about the Hegg carbide? Is it just a metallurgical curiosity?
Oh, definitely not. If you are interested in synthetic fuels, ITA carbide is your best friend. It is a crucial catalyst in the Fischer-Tropsch process.
Okay, break that down. Fischer-Tropsch.
It's a chemical reaction that converts a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen syngas, they call it, into liquid hydrocarbons. Basically, you're turning gas into liquid fuel.
And ITA carbide is the surface where this magic happens.
It is. The surface chemistry is key. The text even mentions that if you sprinkle platinum atoms onto the surface of ITA carbide, specifically the 100 crystal face, it boosts this catalytic activity. It helps stitch those carbon atoms together into fuel chains.
So this unstable steel ghost is actually a workhorse for the chemical industry.
Correct. It might not survive a billion years in a meteorite, but it's absolutely stable enough to run a chemical plant.
Amazing. All right, let's move to the next character. Qi carbide. The text calls this one the low temperature specialist.
Yes. Qi carbide, F2C. This one appears when you temper martensite at low temperatures. But to really study it, to get a lot of it, scientists had to go to extremes.
What extreme are we talking?
Liquid nitrogen temperatures. The text describes an experiment where they cooled carburized steel down to 77 Kelvin.
That's minus 196 Celsius. Why on earth would you make steel that cold?
To stop the iron atoms from moving. Remember we talked about diffusion. If you want to force the steel to form Qi carbide without the iron rearranging itself comfortably, you freeze the iron in place. This forces the crystal structure to change purely by deformation, by shearing and bending the lattice, not by atoms jumping around.
It's a forced transformation, and that affects what it looks like.
It dictates this shape entirely. Qi carbide forms as these lenticular plates. Think of a lens shape or a saucer with these very sharp tips.
And why that shape? Why not a sphere?
It's all about energy. Because the lattice is being forced to change shape under stress, the material wants to minimize the elastic strain energy. A thin lens-shaped plate is just the most energy-efficient way to pack this new structure into the old one without tearing everything apart.
Nature is always lazy, right? Finding the path of least resistance.
Efficient is the word I'd use, but yes.
Now, the text briefly mentions something called the Larson-Miller parameter here. Sounds like a spy thriller. The Larson-Miller parameter. What is it?
It's a tool for engineers. It's a formula that combines time and temperature into a single number. It helps us predict when these carbides will show up or disappear. And it basically proves that if the strength of your heat treatment is high SO, high temp, or long time cementite always wins. Qi carbide only exists at the low end of that scale.
Got it. So Qi is the fragile one that can't take the heat.
Exactly. It burns out fast if you push the parameter too high.
All right, let's talk about our final character, the mysterious Epsilon carbide.
Epsilon, Fe2.4C, This is the hexagonal one, and it is the subject of a huge debate in the scientific community about its structure.
A debate about structure, like where the atoms sit.
Specifically, the carbon atoms. Imagine a hexagonal room of iron atoms. There are little gaps between them called octahedral interstices. The debate is, do the carbon atoms just sit in those gaps randomly, or is there a specific assigned seating chart?
Ordered versus disordered.
Right. And first principles calculations. The heavy math, they say they want to be ordered. Carbon atoms, you know, they want to stay as far apart from each other as possible. They're antisocial.
But they need their personal space.
They really do.
Yeah.
So they occupy specific sites to maximize that distance.
There's another quirk about epsilon carbide in the text. It's always tiny. You can only see it with a transmission electron microscope. Why doesn't it grow big like cementite does?
It comes back to that deformation we talked about with Qi. To turn the iron lattice into the epsilon lattice requires a massive distortion. The material has to stretch and shear significantly.
So if a particle got too big,
the strain would just be too much.
Yeah.
The surrounding iron simply couldn't accommodate it. So epsilon carbide stays as these fine, tiny particles to keep those distortions manageable.
Okay, here's the part that really got me. We've established epsilon is less stable than cementite. We've established it requires this huge mechanical distortion to form. By all accounts, the steel shouldn't want to make it. So why, in the precipitation sequence, does it form first?
That is the transition mystery. Why do we get the hard-to-make, unstable thing before the easy, stable thing?
All right, why not just go straight to cementite?
There are three main theories the text outlines. The first one is all about dislocations.
And dislocations are defects in the crystal.
Yes, linear defects. Think of them as wrinkles in a rug. Carbon atoms love to sit in those wrinkles. It's comfortable there. The binding energy is high.
So the dislocations act like sponges for the carbon.
Exactly. They soak up the carbon first. And the theory is that epsilon carbide simply cannot form until all those dislocations are full. The dislocations steal all the carbon. So you need a high carbon concentration to overwhelm them, allowing epsilon to finally precipitate.
That explains why you see it in high carbon steels. It spills over. What's theory number two?
Clustering. The idea is that carbon atoms form these little multiplets or clusters first. These clusters then undergo an in situ transformation. They transform right where they sit into epsilon. So it's not that the steel chooses epsilon, it's just what happens when these clusters get dense enough.
It's a local accident that becomes a structure. Okay, and the third theory?
Alloying elements. We rarely use pure iron carbon mixes. We add silicon, manganese, aluminum. Silicon in particular is a game changer. It inhibits cementite. It basically blocks cementite from forming.
Play a bouncer at the club.
A very effective bouncer, but it doesn't block epsilon. In fact, some arguments say silicon alters the lattice just enough to make epsilon fit better. It enhances the coherency. So if you add silicon, you are rigging the race in favor of epsilon.
That is fascinating. It's like silicon is the lobbyist for epsilon carbide, keeping it in the game longer than it should be.
That's a great way to put it. And for engineers, that's useful. Epsilon gives you different mechanical properties than cementite.
So we've met the cast. We've gone from the common cementite to the exotic epsilon, Eta and Qi. We've seen them in meteorites making fuel, frozen in liquid nitrogen.
It really changes how you look at a piece of steel. You realize it's not just a static block of metal. It's a frozen battlefield of these competing phases.
The text calls them transient phases.
They are. Over eons, they'll disappear. But here's the thing. We don't use steel over eons. We use it over decades. And during the human timescale, the time scale of manufacturing a car part or building a bridge, these so-called transient phases are the ones that actually dictate the material's properties.
That's a powerful thought. We are building our entire world on the metastable.
We rely on the good enough for now state of matter.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with that provocative thought from the very end of the chapter. It kind of blew my mind.
Ah, the zero Kelvin problem.
Yeah. Unpack that for us.
Well, almost all the calculations we've been talking about, the math that tells us epsilon is unstable or how the atoms should order themselves, those are epiquant at zero Kelvin. Absolute zero.
A temperature where nothing moves, a purely theoretical state.
And at zero pressure, usually. But the real world is not absolute zero. In the real world, as you heat steel up, things change. Magnetic properties change. Heat capacity changes. The vibrations of the atoms. Everything changes.
So the map we're using is frozen, but the territory is dynamic.
Exactly. The text points out that if you actually account for magnetic terms and temperature, the stability ranking might shift. What we think we know about stability might just be a snapshot of a frozen theoretical world, not the hot, magnetic, vibrating reality of the steel in your engine block.
So are we really even sure that cementite is the ultimate winner? Or is it just the winner at the finish line of a race that never truly ends?
That is the question. And it suggests that even in a material as old and as studied as steel, there is still plenty of mystery left to explore.
I love it. A secret menu of carbides, a battle for stability, and a reminder that our scientific maps are just that, approximations of a much more complex reality.
It keeps the metallurgists employed.
It certainly does. Thank you for guiding us through the lattice today, and thank you to our listeners for diving deep with us. Next time you look at a steel beam, just remember, there is a whole lot more going on in there than just iron and carbon.
Until next time.
Stay curious.